My name is Nathaniel House. I'm a judge of the Illinois Appellate Court, and presiding over the case with me are Justices Terry Lavin and Cynthia Cobbs. We're going to proceed as follows today. We're going to allow each side to have 10 minutes of uninterrupted presentation, followed by questions by the justices, beginning first with the appellant. Who is the attorney who's going to make a presentation for the appellant today?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jennifer Bongean on behalf of Mr. Butler.
Thank you. And who's going to make a presentation on behalf of the state today?
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant State's Attorney Joseph Alexander on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Thank you. Do either one of you have any questions about how we're going to proceed today?
Judge, should I reserve rebuttal?
Yes, you can take a short period of time for rebuttal. Yes.
Okay.
We may have questions then as well. We may. With that, Ms. Bongean, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Selma Butler was convicted of the brutal slaying of Angela Young, based primarily on recanted grand jury testimony of a 14-year-old child. That child was Earl Gilmore, and he was held incommunicado by Area 1 detectives before providing that grand jury testimony that he promptly disavowed once he was released from custody. Mr. Butler has always maintained his innocence. He sought forensic testing, which he eventually did receive with the consent of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and after he was able to obtain pro bono counsel. And eventually, the Conviction Integrity Unit of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office conducted a reinvestigation of the case. This investigation yielded substantial new evidence, at least new to Mr. Butler, that forms the basis of his post-conviction, his successive post-conviction petition that was denied in the court below. The state implicitly agrees that Mr. Butler was entitled to an evidentiary hearing because it devotes a lion's share of its brief to speculating about such things as trial strategy and disputing facts that are more appropriately contested at an evidentiary hearing, not at a second stage post-conviction proceeding, and certainly not on appeal. Even after the Office of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office acknowledged serious concerns with the integrity of Mr. Butler's conviction, it successfully fought to prevent an evidentiary hearing in this very troubling case. Turning first to Mr. Butler's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the state's case turned on Earl Gilmore's recanted testimony. Earl Gilmore testified at trial that his grand jury testimony was not true, that it had been a product of police coercion, that he feared that he would be charged, and that he came into court and said none of it's true. The state nonetheless admitted the prior testimony as substantive evidence. But what is most problematic is that Mr. Butler's trial counsel did nothing to challenge that prior grand jury testimony. As the court is aware from the briefs, this was a murder trial that lasted probably 40, 45 minutes. In total, trial counsel asked 13 questions of all the witnesses and no opening statement. His closing remarks were about 90 seconds long. And he did absolutely nothing with both available evidence. And of course, we know from the investigation that was conducted in 2015 that there was evidence that was available with just a minimal investigation. A very short, just a modest investigation would have revealed that there was much to question about Mr. Gilmore's prior grand jury testimony. Specifically, we know that another alleged witness, Antonio Thomas, who also, not surprisingly, recanted his testimony there was no prior grand jury testimony, but recanted an alleged oral statement, which we know was a false statement because the manner of death did not actually match the forensic evidence. Antonio Thomas's testimony was available. And we know from a 2015 report that the Conviction Integrity Unit, which memorialized an interview that the Conviction Integrity Unit did, that he was maintains to this day, I was never in Ms. Young's house. I never witnessed a murder. I have no reason to know one way or the other whether Mr. Butler did. So that evidence was available to trial counsel for Mr. Butler. Just looking at the forensic evidence, there was no effort to even cross-examine Mr. Gilmore's to challenge the prior grand jury testimony. We know the forensic evidence showed that there was a double instrumented blade used in this killing. Again, this was nothing that Mr. Gilmore said during his grand jury testimony. One would assume if he was actually a witness, he would have noticed that somebody used a scissors or some type of double-edged blade. We know that there's no evidence of a struggle on Mr. Butler or his co-defendant, despite the fact that Mr. Gilmore said in his prior grand jury testimony that there were scratches. We have pictures of these children. And let's be clear, these were children. Mr. Wilson was 15 years old. Mr. Butler was 19. The pictures of them do not reflect any injuries to their face, to their body, and there's no mention of any injuries, which would be hard to pull off stabbing a 34-year-old woman who had defensive wounds. I don't know what it was, 50, 60 times. There was no effort to speak to Farrah Hubbard, who was a witness mentioned in Earl Gilmore's grand jury testimony, where he said they went there immediately after the this bloody incident occurred. Farrah Hubbard told, although she did not want to provide an affidavit herself, she did provide statements to staff that works for me that I have no knowledge about this, no involvement, no bloody children showed up at my house at any point. Again, evidence that trial counsel just needed to talk to her at the time. We know that Geno Wilson himself was available as a witness. He had been acquitted. He no longer enjoyed double jeopardy protections. And he was interviewed in 2014 and 2018 and maintains to this day that he was not part of this this vicious murder and that he has no reason to believe Mr. Butler was, or at least he did not see Mr. Butler commit any of these offenses. And then there was no effort to even cross-examine the police officers about the circumstances of this interrogation. Again, these were children that were held incommunicado in police stations without interested minors. So we have a scenario, Your Honors, where trial counsel did nothing. And it is not an overstatement to say that Mr. Butler would have been as well represented by, frankly, a potted plant. And I have to assume that that is because he believed and had some reason to believe that Mr. Butler would be acquitted like the co-defendant and he was just phoning it in. But that is not trial strategy. And at a minimum, there needed to be an evidentiary hearing. This is a serious case. Mr. Butler's life was ruined. He is with us today, having served his entire sentence. And he is entitled to that evidentiary hearing where his claims of innocence and his claims of ineffectiveness can be vetted in a evidentiary hearing, not in papers where we are disputing facts that have no business being disputed in appellate briefs. Now, I would like to at this point move on to the very and concerning Brady claim that was discovered. As the court may well know from reading the briefs, that there was a police report that was produced during the conviction integrity unit investigation to Ms. Zellner, who previously represented Mr. Butler, that strongly suggested, as other evidence does, that there was significant evidence of third-party culpability by three other individuals, older members of a gang who had a significant drug operation going on in that building and who apparently had connections to that apartment. This police report was not in the public defender's file. This was not a file. Yes, this was not a file, Your Honor, that we had access to physically, but we were able to get an electronic copy and it just wasn't in there. This demands an evidentiary hearing to determine for where the prosecutors, trial attorneys can testify about this significant third-party culpability evidence that was not developed, that was not even hinted at during these proceedings. There's strong evidence that if it was not in the public defender's file, then the public defender did not have it. And People versus Beeman is directly on point, Your Honors. And in Beeman, I would point out there was an evidentiary hearing. And ultimately, there was relief granted on this issue. So People versus Beeman of the Illinois Supreme Court decision demands that this go back for an evidentiary hearing. And finally, Your Honors, there was DNA evidence that was developed. It was not, as we acknowledge in our briefs, as conclusive as we would have liked, because there were so many mixtures of male DNA. But what we do know is that Mr. Butler was excluded from at least two of those sources of blood, and this would have been evidence that he could have used. It's new evidence. The remaining blood stains do not implicate him in any way, because they don't exclude about the majority of the African-American population. So we have a body of evidence here that is presumed to be true at this juncture. We were entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Mr. Butler was entitled to an evidentiary hearing. He was entitled to a fair trial the first go around. He did not get one. He did not get his Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. He got a rubber stamping of his conviction, and and that grave injustice needs to be undone. Thank you.
Thank you. You have questions, Justice Lavin?
Yeah, I have a few. In trying to, you know, compare, this is one of the more unusual cases that I've ever dealt with in my 13 years in the appellate court here. But we have two defendants, co-defendants, who were tried in bench trials in front of the same judge. The first guy gets off, the second guy gets 50 years.
Right.
What was the difference in the proof that the state had in this case compared to the case for Wilson?
So the difference in the proof, and we'll acknowledge, is that Antonio Thomas, which Antonio Thomas did not give prior grand jury testimony, so they weren't able to introduce his prior grand jury testimony substantively. The other piece of evidence that was used against Mr. Butler was an alleged inculpatory oral statement. That he, of course, has always maintained he would never made, and it wasn't exactly a confession. It just was a statement by Area 1 detectives that he admitted during a polygraph that he had been there. The problem is that the prosecution's theory of the case was identical in both cases. So if you did not believe that there was sufficient evidence to demonstrate this theory of the case as to Geno Wilson, it is hard to understand how the court could have reached a different conclusion as to Selma Butler. If you don't believe that Antonio Thomas and Earl Gilmore's statements and about what happened were in fact what happened, then it's hard to understand how you could have reached a different conclusion. Although technically speaking, the evidence was slightly different. I would not say it was necessarily stronger, but because the state was not able to introduce Antonio Thomas's prior grand jury testimony, because there was none, Mr. Wilson was acquitted.
Did Gilmore testify at Wilson's trial?
He did not.
And at the trial of Mr. Butler, his public defender, who by all accounts is a competent attorney, asked all of four questions of the police officer who allegedly took this statement, a statement that was never memorialized, wasn't signed off on, wasn't written, wasn't recorded, nothing. Four
That's
questions.
Right. You're right, Your Honor. Again, even back in 1995, I think we had an idea that holding children incommunicado could produce results, unreliable statements, and there was just no effort to challenge it. And again, it is mind-boggling to me. I can only assume that what happened here is that he assumed and not guilty. But you can't make those types of assumptions.
the state, I don't know what the state was assuming either, because both parties waived opening statement.
That's right.
I've never seen a record like this. Waive opening statement, first witnesses, no questions, then four questions, then, you know, didn't even need a lunch break and the case is over.
Yes, that's right. And I don't think this is our proudest moment in our criminal justice system. Human lives should be treated differently. And Mr. Butler's life was not treated with the care and with the due process protections and the Sixth Amendment protections he was owed.
Okay, now what is it specifically that you believe that the court would be allowed to consider if the case was sent back on the actual innocence claim?
So on the actual innocence claim, Your Honor, I do believe that the evidence that excluded him from blood evidence, and there doesn't seem to be any other explanation for why blood would be there, would be admitted simply as new evidence going towards innocence. I think in conjunction with some of the other evidence, it becomes a very, very strong case of actual innocence. The problem is that some of this stuff, and we admit, was available to trial counsel had he just done his job. This was a not guilty. Any competent attorney should have gotten a not guilty, but because there was no investigation, obviously, and even stuff that was in the police reports, the information that was in the police reports was not adequately used. So it's both the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and yes, of course, the new evidence that we have developed in connection with the DNA, but we believe that a showing of ineffectiveness would show that there is a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different on this very, very slim case.
Now, in reading through the record and the briefs and everything, I got a little bit confused as to when Kathleen Zellner was involved and when you became involved. Did you have any interactions with the Conviction Integrity Unit, or was that with Ms. Zellner?
So that's a good question, Judge. So when I came into the case, Ms. Zellner had actually, because the CIU had not taken action at the time, I don't know what her logic was. Maybe she didn't want to file a post-conviction petition, but she did not actually file a post-conviction petition. I did reach out to the Conviction Integrity Unit because I did not understand why they reached the conclusion they did. And they decided again to reopen the case once I came on. And that was Fabio Valentini told me, we're going to reopen and relook at this case. So they continued to do that. But then there was a changing of the guard when Ms. Fox came in and things just got delayed. My client was just languishing.
I mean, this entire case is justice delayed.
Yes. So I just said, I threw my hands up and I said, you know what? I'm going to put my faith in the courts. I'm not waiting for the CIU.
Because at some point, the CIU indicated that they had, I don't know if the word was grave, but that they had concerns about what had happened in terms of this conviction, right?
That's right. Mr. Rodert said, we have serious concerns, but we're not at a point where we're going to take action. You know, there was a lot of delay even in the CIU, and it just wasn't acceptable to me to continue to wait for an answer that I didn't know was ever going to come. So I had to move forward.
Last question. Did you ask the state to just simply agree to have a hearing?
I most certainly did. And I did not understand why the state would just not agree. And they continued to maintain that the CIU and the post-conviction unit were separate units that made their own decisions, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, who knows? Maybe they'll agree today.
Maybe.
One can hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Cobbs, any questions?
Yes, if I only have one question, and it really is for a point of clarification from Ms. Bongean.
Yes.
Do I understand you to say that if we were to remand for an evidentiary hearing, that the greater substance of what you would put before the court in your actual innocence claim has to do wholly or largely with the ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
So what I'm saying is we have this independent ineffective assistance of counsel claim that would take center stage at an evidentiary hearing, because I cannot in good faith argue that some of this evidence is actually new. It was new to Mr. Butler, but it was not new to his attorney. And Therefore, it's his failings for why a jury and the fact finder never learned of it. So it does ultimately go to his innocence, of course, but legally, the legal framework is through an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And yes, we do have the actual innocence based on the DNA, which is in fact new, but the legal framework is through an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And of course, we have the Brady claim as well, which deals with the third party culpability.
And do you anticipate, is this a successive PC?
It was a successive PC, but it was docketed, meaning the court did a cause and prejudice analysis prior to docketing the case. She docketed it for further consideration and then dismissed it on the state's motion to dismiss. But it was a successive petition. And I would point out that Mr. Butler's first, his original post-conviction petition, he did allege generally that his counsel was ineffective, but he didn't have access to any of the details. He just knew his lawyer didn't do a good job. And he had no specifics because he didn't have access to any of the police reports. He didn't have the benefit of the CIU reports. He didn't have all of that information. Of course, he's indigent. He had no representation. So we know he knew in his heart that he didn't get a good, he didn't get effective assistance of counsel. But that is why it's successive, is because there was an original petition brought.
Do you anticipate that there is going to be any barrier to your proceeding on any of the ineffective assistance claims?
No, Judge. We've argued, we hope not, and we hope the court would agree with us that we demonstrated cause because our ineffectiveness claim is based to a significant degree on materials that were developed by the Conviction Integrity Unit in 2015. It was information that trial counsel could have developed if he had done his job, but he did not. So we have materials now that was developed in 2015, which satisfies the cause test. And of course, we know that Mr. Butler could not have gotten police reports. His attorney couldn't even give those to him under the Illinois Supreme Court rules. And the question of whether there was prejudice, I think we've easily established there was prejudice in this trial, where there was really just no. I think it borders on a United States versus Chronic type of scenario, where there just really was no defense put up, no effort whatsoever, which I think the record reflects.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bongean, are you actually putting forth the theory that your client now has newly discovered evidence of ineffective assistance? Is that what you're saying, that we knew he knew he got a bum deal from the first trial, but it's only since 2015 I got evidence to show that he was really ineffective? Is that what your theory is?
That's one way to put it. I would say that it demonstrates cause, that because it wasn't available to my client in 2000, it could have been developed by trial counsel. So we know, for instance, Antonio Thomas was available as a witness. We know Gino Wilson was available as a witness. We know those people could have testified. But we now have Conviction Integrity Unit reports that my client didn't have, and police reports, which establishes cause for his failure to bring the claims earlier. And that's what our legal argument is on that.
All right. Any other questions?
No.
Right. No.
Okay, Mr. Alexander, you may proceed when you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Assistant State's Attorney Joseph Alexander on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. Our arguments are laid out in our briefs, and I'll just keep it as brief as possible in this very complex case. When we're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel at this stage, defendant has a burden, and defendant has a burden of making a substantial showing of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. In this case, defendant has not met his burden. One of the things defendant must do, if he's claiming that there are new witnesses or there are witnesses willing to testify on his behalf in his defense, is to supply affidavits from those witnesses. Affidavits saying that these witnesses, what they will attest to, and that they are willing to testify at a subsequent hearing or trial. Defendant has not done that. So on that basis, he has not met his burden under the Post-Conviction Hearing Act in establishing a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. And if we look at his claim and the arguments that he's making, it is in clear violation of Strickland, which is you don't posit what another attorney would have done. And that's basically what this argument is. another attorney would have tried this case differently. And as the United States Supreme Court has held, there are different ways, many different ways of trying a case. And in this case, counsel's way of trying this case was not objectively unreasonable given the facts and the circumstances of this case. What we have here is that we have a witness who testified at a grand jury that the defendant was involved in this crime. Although he testified at trial that he attempted, that grand jury testimony was substantially corroborated by the physical evidence. And we also have a statement given by defendant placing himself at the scene. Now, defendant did not admit to participating in the murder or, and that's a point that we will make out and we will concede, but he did place himself at the scene. And so what we have now is counsel faced with a statement and grand jury testimony that is substantially corroborated by the physical evidence, and counsel proceeded based on a trial strategy that counsel thought was appropriate at the time. And based on that, we cannot make a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel just because counsel's trial strategy proved unsuccessful.
I'm gonna interrupt you there because I'm just extremely frustrated with the testimony of this young man, Mr. Gilmore. He was a sixth grader, right?
I believe he was 15 at the time, 14 or 15 at the time, Your Honor.
In the record that I read, he was a sixth grader. He was 14 years old, but a sixth grader. Okay.
Right. Okay. Right.
And in his disavowed grand jury testimony, he said that he saw defendant and co-defendant get on the elevator and press the button for the 13th floor. I don't know how the heck he could see what button they're pushing. And then he says that he and his friend went up the stairs and ran up the stairs, and they got to the 13th floor at the same time that the elevator got there. Seems to me that there's a lot of holes in this testimony that were never dealt with. You know, that client just, the attorney just pressed the mute button. How is that effective assistance of counsel?
Your Honor, what we are dealing with here is we're looking at counsel's performance in hindsight. And even if we decide that counsel was ineffective, even if we find that counsel's performance was deficient, we have to go to that second prong of Strickland, which is whether the defendant suffered prejudice. And defendant's entire argument, I won't say that, that's a misrepresentation. It's not his entire argument. But part of his argument is that the witness was coerced and he gave this false statement, but there's no evidence of that coercion. And we also have this statement of defendant placing himself at the scene. So there is corroboration for that grand jury testimony, and the trier of fact heard that, and counsel proceeded in a way that counsel thought was appropriate at the time. And under Strickland, we have to give counsel's performance, you have to give that strategy a certain amount of deference.
Now I'm going to interrupt. Counsel, though, we defer to strategy as long as it's reasonable. Can you honestly sit here before us this morning and in light of what Justice Levin pointed out with respect to counsel's performance at trial, can you honestly state to us that there was serious adversarial testing in this case?
Your Honor, I will argue that even if we concede that counsel's performance was deficient, we have to go to that second prong of prejudice. And assuming that this court finds that counsel's performance was deficient, looking at the prejudice, this defendant, the probability of this trial being different is minuscule because of this grand jury testimony and defendant's own statement. And that grand jury testimony being substantially corroborated by the physical evidence. And so my argument to this court, based on the facts of this case and the arguments that I can make in good faith, is that we have to look at both prongs and not simply look at whether counsel performed deficiently.
I'm here to tell you, I'm here to tell you that in a murder case where somebody gets 50 years in prison for a lawyer to ask four questions at trial, that is not just ineffective assistance, that's feckless, okay? And I don't understand it, because I'm sure he is a competent attorney. He's gone on to other jobs and has done a great job, but something was amiss here. And a man sat in prison all this time on some of the skinniest evidence that I've ever seen. This is a statement that wasn't written, recorded, et cetera. It was disavowed. And the sixth grader who testified was in jail on a curfew violation when the police tell him to go in and talk to the grand jury and tell him what to say. I see a lot of cause. I see a lot of prejudice. And what I don't understand, and I respect the work that your office does, trust me, I really do. But what I don't understand is why, with all of this, and then you throw in the DNA and the Pearson report and all this other stuff, why at the end of the proverbial day here, didn't you agree to an evidentiary hearing? Why don't you agree today? You can agree today.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. With all due respect, I cannot simply agree to an evidentiary hearing after this has gotten to this level of briefed out and argument. And as I'm sitting here right now, my argument is a good faith argument. And I understand where this court is coming from about the defendant and the amount of evidence at this case. But we have two different things that have happened in this case. We have multiple things that have happened in this case. We have a situation where this went through our conviction integrity unit, and they investigated, and it was a multiple year investigation, and they came to the conclusion that this case should not be vacated, that they stood by the conviction. Defendant then went through the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, which is absolutely his right to do. But in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, there are standards and burdens that the defendant has to meet. And we, as the office, looked at this case and determined that the defendant did not meet his burden of making a substantial showing of his claims. Defendant then filed a notice of appeal, and it got to my desk, where I looked at this case, and there is a good faith argument that I can make based on what was made in the trial court that the defendant has not met his burden. And if this court feels that this evidence is insufficient, that this defendant is entitled to an evidentiary hearing, I, of course, absolutely respect the court's decision. And if this goes back for an evidentiary hearing, that is this court's ruling, and the state will abide by that ruling.
And we respect your professionalism and your dedication to justice. We do, okay? I get it. But it just seems like in this case that at some point in time, a decision was made to rely on technicalities or some certain procedural defaults or faults instead of having an evidentiary hearing. But I get where you're coming from.
And Your Honor, that is part of our argument. There are technical aspects that need to be addressed, but there is also, again, our position that even though this evidence may be considered slight, or it may be considered circumstantial, courts in Illinois have held that circumstantial evidence is sufficient to convict a defendant. And when looking at this case, based on the evidence that we have and the way that it was tried in the trial court and the way that this case has played out, it was our position that this evidence was sufficient and defendant didn't meet his burden. And that is simply, at this juncture, that is simply our argument. Whether that argument is persuasive is yet to be seen. Again, if this court finds that we have not persuaded it, that we have met our burdens, that defendant has not made a substantial showing, then of course the remedy would be for an evidentiary hearing. As to the actual innocence claim, again, when we're looking at that, there are elements that the defendant has to meet. And if this were simply a matter of the conviction integrity unit, then that is a different animal in and of itself, because the defendant does not have any burdens when it comes to the conviction integrity unit. If a case is raised where a defendant has concerns, and the conviction integrity unit sees those concerns and then investigates, they will make a recommendation. In this case, they investigated and they did not recommend to vacate the sentence. At this juncture, when defendant is arguing that he is actually innocent based on DNA evidence, again, the parameters, the things that the defendant has to satisfy is whether, you know, this evidence was newly discovered, whether it was cumulative, whether it was conclusive. And our position is that the evidence is not newly discovered. We can see that it is, DNA evidence can be relevant. And in this case, it was not cumulative because there was no DNA evidence presented. But we argue that it wasn't conclusive. Being excluded from two samples and not being excluded from others does not conclusively show that the defendant did not commit this crime when we look at the totality of the other evidence. And that's something that we have to do. And what we have, what was submitted at trial, what was considered by the trier of fact, was the grand jury testimony and the testimony that the defendant made a statement. So based on that and the lack of conclusiveness with the DNA evidence, we argue that the defendant has not met his burdens of satisfying the elements of a claim of actual innocence. And if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'm happy to answer, or at least attempt to answer.
I'm done badgering you, and I apologize if I came off in terms of my tone as being disrespectful. The opposite is true. You've been in front of us many times, and you're a pro, and you're doing a good job, and you're doing your job. So thank you.
And I want to say it was Justice Lavin who led me astray to violate protocol, which was to allow you to speak without interruption.
That is all right. I will tell you, I prefer to get questions as soon as possible. If you have no other questions, for the reasons stated here and those stated in our briefs, we ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you. I don't have any questions. And we did allow you a little bit of extra time because of the questions. Thank you. Ms. Banjean, you can take a short rebuttal. You're muted. You have to unmute.
I did. Thank you, Your Honor. My apologies. I just want to touch on a couple of points. First of all, counsel has suggested multiple times that Earl Gilmore's prior grand jury testimony was corroborated by the physical evidence. It just wasn't. That's part of the problem. There is a chart at page 19 of my brief in which I laid out some of the physical evidence that simply was not corroborated by the prior grand jury testimony, including, for instance, Earl Gilmore said that the victim was stabbed in the face. That didn't happen. We have pictures. We know she wasn't stabbed in the face. Earl Gilmore said the victim scratched Gina Wilson in the face. That didn't happen. We have pictures of Gina Wilson, and the police reports do not indicate he was scratched in the face. We know that, again, the autopsy report reveals that the victim was stabbed with a double-bladed instrument, like a scissors. Earl Gilmore says she was stabbed with a knife. Again, the physical evidence is actually refuted by Earl Gilmore's prior grand jury testimony, which should have raised red flags for everybody. Trial strategy. It's not just any old trial strategy. It has to be sound trial strategy. And there's just no evidence that there was any sound trial strategy that went on here. The counsel said there's no evidence of coercion of Earl Gilmore. Not so. Earl Gilmore essentially said so, that he was afraid. He was told he was going to be charged. That is coercion. We also know that Antonio Thomas made a statement that this woman was beaten to death with a crowbar. She wasn't beaten to death. So the fact that children are making completely false statements should have raised red flags. And lastly, I think we get past the prejudice prong. By counsel's own admission, this was a slim case. Just imagine what a competent attorney or an attorney who was doing his job with sound trial strategy could have done with a case like this. Mr. Butler probably would not have served a 50-year sentence in the Illinois Department of Corrections. So with that, Your Honors, unless you have any additional questions, I have no further rebuttal.
Thank you. Any questions?
I actually have a mute button. I just pressed it.
All right. Very well. Well, thank you. You both presented great arguments. The case was well argued, well briefed. We appreciate the professionalism of both of you. We will take this case under advisement and issue a decision in due course.